Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. This show is part of a series I'm doing on breakthrough solutions, demonstrating that seemingly impossible problems actually have solutions, and these solutions are working in the United States right now. Our show today is about a breakthrough solution in education. My guest is Deborah Meyer. Deborah Meyer is best known as the founder and principal of a remarkable high school in Harlem called Central Park East. She started as a Head Start and kindergarten teacher and went on to found three kindergarten through grade 6 and one grade 7 to 12 public schools in East Harlem and in Boston. Deborah Meyer is Emeritus Chair of the Coalition of Essential Schools, author of many books, including The Power of Their Ideas, about her experience in running the schools in Harlem. She's the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award for her work in education, currently a blogger, and much, much more. Deborah Meyer, I am honored and delighted to welcome you to All Together Now.
Hello, Eleanor. Hello. Nice to be on this. And nice to hear your voice saying
yes.
All those wonderful things about me.
Yeah, oh, of course, and they're all true. And I've been looking.
But you didn't mention my children or my grandchildren or your daughter. Or
that's right, all the most important things.
The most important things.
Fortunately, we have an hour. We can get to it all.
Oh, good.
So, you know, you have created these amazing public schools with great results for students. And I first learned of your work through the Central Park East High School, where 90% of the students graduated and 90% of them went to college. So for our listeners who may not be as familiar with your wonderful work as I happily am, could you say a little bit about what you did at Central Park East in Harlem to get those results?
Well, there's two parts to the story. One, what I did, and one, what the system did to make me and some other people come up with sometimes slightly different or somewhat very different solutions that I think also worked. So let me just start with the second part of that, and that was that I got an invitation from a remarkable young man who had been chosen to be superintendent in East Harlem. I think his background was actually Head Start also. And he said, would you like to start a school in East Harlem? And I'll find some space for you. You can select your colleagues, and you can recruit parents from, you know, any way you think best. And but they won't be assigned to your school. So what would you do if you did that? And first I thought he was just putting me on, but I went to meet with him, and I described some things that I might do, and he really meant it. So it was the degree of support and very competent and strategic support, as well as personal and financial support. Actually, we didn't get any more money, but we got greater flexibility about how to spend our money. Mm-hmm. We had the advantage of starting the school with which most schools start this way, with a self-selected staff. And and we had the advantage of a superintendent who was creative. And when I presented him with a problem, he would say, well, let's not worry about that part of it, meaning some of the technical bureaucratic requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that made it more fun.
Mm-hmm.
And when he visited the school, he never over the next about 7 years, he started 21 new schools, no, maybe more than that, that were not neighborhood zoned, and maintained all the neighborhood schools so that every parent in East Harlem had a choice between going to their neighborhood school or choosing among the 20-something different schools that were located within those same buildings. Some of them early childhood, some of them K through 6, some of them 6, 7 through 9. At that time, there was no, the high schools weren't not part of his responsibility. So that was done in collaboration with the central board. But and the district, because we made it a 7 through 12 partly so that we would, he would continue to have some voice in the redesign of the secondary school. But it was that enormous sense that if we thought something was right, we would try it. And if it turned out that it wasn't quite right, we could revise it. And if it turned out to be a terrible idea, we could drop it. It gave us a kind of freedom, and the students and the parents, that they could raise questions with us, and the answer wouldn't be, well, we have no power over that, or we can't do that, or, well, we just got permission to do that, so it doesn't come up until another year that our waiver is, you know, all the things that make it hard to edit and revise a school, just like you do your own writing. And it changes the way parents, students, and faculty feel about a school. They're by choice. In our case, in the beginning at Central Park East, it was largely families thought we might be able to handle kids who regular schools were having trouble with. So the population was not necessarily difficult kids, but kids who were idiosyncratic. Each one stood out. And that complicates teaching. Sometimes you have a class that just goes along. Two-thirds of the kids, whether they're talented or untalented, they don't fight you about anything. Mm-hmm. And then the stragglers join in. Mm-hmm. But this was a – we started off with parents and kids who had been frustrated by their previous experiences. Well, and a staff that had been frustrated by their previous experiences. But they weren't all frustrated about the same experience. So right. We had to do a lot of adjusting and changing and asking ourselves the tough questions.
Well, and on this point, this is really important because some of the people who looked at the incredible results you were getting out of the Central Park East High School were saying, well, you know, you cherry-picked the students, and these were all high-performing students anyway.
No,
but
no, we never even in the elementary school, we never met the kids. We told the parents we didn't want to be. We were the only reason we insisted they visit first was that we thought it was important for parents to know what they were getting into. Mm-hmm. Because so that we had that advantage. There's nobody sent their kid to our school who said, this is exactly what I don't want for my child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helps. But beyond that, and even a few of the parents who came after they saw the school changed their mind and transferred. So we did have a few kids, especially in the early years, who were... what amazed me, Eleanor, was the faith that parents did have, since we were so different than so many schools that they were accustomed to. And I think it was in some ways that they had faith in us. They got to know us.
Mm-hmm.
They got to listen to the way the kids talked about us. They saw us often. We were very reachable. So I think that was enormously important, and just as important when we started the secondary school, that parents understood that it, just because their kids were now 14 and wanted them to go away somewhere, they were not going to go away, and the school was going to deal with the family as a unit, and we were not going to undermine parental power and parental voice.
Mm-hmm.
And we really built a sufficiently trusting relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That parents told us things and helped us with things that could otherwise have happened very differently.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, as you know, what our listeners are just about to discover, I am one of those parents because after your, you know, I learned about your work as I was doing this research on Breakthrough Solutions, and then my husband and I had a daughter who was becoming of school age, and I actually had talked to Jack and said, gee, I'd love to move to Harlem to see if we can get Veronica into Central Park East. You know, at the elementary school and then built the high school later. But lucky for us, you decided to move to Boston and set up one of these wonderful schools in Roxbury, Massachusetts. So You know, would you say that you basically use the same principles and approach for the Mission Hill School in Roxbury, Massachusetts that you did in New York, or was it very different?
Well, the only difference was that we didn't have an Alvarado, the superintendent of District 4, and what we had was an outside or nonprofit called the Center for Collaborative Education that had pretty good relationships with the chancellor at the time. What was he called? Superintendent. Tom Paysant. And they had worked out an approach in cooperation with the union that gave us some of the, formally, some of the same freedom and flexibility that Tony Alvarado had given us informally. And that was very helpful because we didn't have to hide as much. I don't know. Even though Alvarado gave us this freedom, he was happy that we didn't flaunt it. And whereas in Boston, we felt part of our purpose was to flaunt it because it was we were part of an experiment to see what it would happen if schools had more freedom and more flexibility on both of the contract that had been signed by both management and labor. In other words, we were freed from virtually all the language in the contract, the exception of wages and benefits. And we were learning all together what the pluses of that is, what the minuses. And we were learning also how different schools use that freedom and flexibility. And I would say that on the whole, there were some commonalities across the board, but there were also substantial differences between the small schools in New York and the small schools in Boston. One of our ideas was that schools should be small enough so that this kind of exchange that I was describing and revising and coming back and forth could take place. You could all sit around one table and someone has a great idea and you can look each other in the eye and flesh it out right then and there and put it into practice the next day. And it's hard to do if you have a faculty of 60, 70 people. But it also meant that parents could meet with it, could get to know the whole faculty, not just the teacher that their child had. So, which meant that they could think ahead about where their child was going as well as where they had come from. So size, we thought, wouldn't by itself cure any of these problems, but they made it easier to tackle. And that was true of the small schools in Boston. They called themselves pilot schools. But the idea was that the system was going to learn from what we experienced and try to spread these ideas through all schools. I don't think that quite happened.
Yes, that certainly did not happen, and I want to talk about that in just a minute. But before we get into the learning from the great schools you created, I just want to talk a little bit about Veronica as one of the students in your school, and she definitely, you know, we adopted her when she was almost five, and she had a lot of learning challenges, you know, diagnosed with dyslexia and attention deficit hyperactive disorder and all kinds of challenges with her, and she had kind of struggled in her kindergarten and first grade in another school, and then lucky for us, as she was moving ahead, you opened that amazing Mission Hill Elementary School in Roxbury, Massachusetts, and as a student there, I just saw a huge shift in Veronica. She went from hating school, literally, in her old school. She would, when I would walk her to school, she'd sit down on the sidewalk and fold her arms and just, you know, scream at me saying, I am not going into school. So she hated going in there. But when it came to the Mission Hill School, she loved going there. And in fact, I remember talking with her at the end of the school year, and she was very sad that she had to take summer vacation and wouldn't be able to go to school through the summer. So, you know, you're doing something right in a school where a student is that enthusiastic about showing up and learning. So
you and
your faculty did an amazing job with Veronica, so I want to thank you for that.
Well, you're more than welcome. I think it was Heidi was your teacher the first year?
Yes.
And Heidi remembers her with such joy, too. And the remarkable thing was, here was a child who had all kinds of problems about learning to read. But she was a story. She loved being read to. And that's partly something that you and Jack obviously did with her. But she had a storyteller's genius. She was imaginative. She loved the outdoors. They were really very strong assets that she carried with her. And if you start looking at children for those assets, it's easier for them to have fun in school, and it's easier to have fun with them. So she occasionally drove us crazy, but most of the time, her incredible enthusiasm was matched by things she could do with that enthusiasm. And I agree with you that it was a learning experience for us and for Veronica.
Yes.
And we were sorry when she moved to Washington.
Yes, we were all sorry about her having to leave that school. She just really thrived there. And some of the things that I noticed that you and your faculty did that really worked for her, looking at Veronica is kind of a case study of how does a student actually go through the kinds of schools you set up. But what the teachers did is they kind of looked at her, and exactly like you said, looking for where she had strengths and assets and drawing on those, and where she had interests. So she had a lot of interest in nature and horses and bugs and birds. And so Heidi, the teacher, brought in the bird and the lizard and books about nature. And you're right about her. She had real, real trouble reading with the dyslexia and so forth. But I think it was one of the tutors you had at the school, Brenda, was working with her and said that Veronica was the most literate non-reader she had ever met.
Right.
She loved story and she loved being read to, but she had real struggle just actually knowing what the words on the page were saying. So, that kind of seeing her strength through the weakness was really great, because her other school, they were just looking at the weakness and categorizing her as, difficult.
Yeah, imagine what it's like to spend day after day after day focused on things that you're not good at.
Right.
We don't do, one of the pleasures, even when we go to college, is we can choose which courses to take, and we take a hard course that we know we're going to struggle with, but we also match that with one course we know we're going to love. We try to, throughout life, play to our strengths while on the side we also work to increase our strengths. But so many schools, once they latch on to what a child is weak in, think they can't do anything until they cure the weakness, which is, of course, to some degree, never cured. It's,
right.
It's how you handle that weakness that helps.
Right.
You.
And developing strategies to draw on your strengths to, catapult you beyond the weakness.
I've never had a good sense of direction. So I became an expert at maps and at landmarks and all kinds of other things because in Boston, if you don't have a sense of direction, it's hard to drive. So I had to develop a lot of, anyone would have to in Boston, but I already had a lot of strategies.
Yes.
For a city that has no north, south, east, and west.
Yes. Well, I want to give you an update here on how your focus, your educational approach and your faculty focus on Veronica's strength has led to her current career. Because one of the teachers, her next teacher was Alphonse, and I think it was third and fourth grade, and Alphonse noticed that Veronica was very good with her hands. I think they met actually in the parking lot of the school where Alphonse and Veronica worked together to fix a flat tire. And so he right away noticed Veronica was good with her hands. He set up a carpenter's bench or a workbench in the classroom. So when it came time to do assignments on Greek civilization or Egyptian civilization, Veronica could build something as opposed to at that point she really couldn't write very well, read or write well. So she was allowed to build something, and she felt a full participant and loved it and really got into the building. And when Veronica did ultimately graduate from high school, which is a huge achievement for a lot of the students with her background, she graduated from high school, she went into a carpenter's apprentice program, and she's currently working full-time as a carpenter building the African American Museum on the National Mall.
Oh, I'm so happy. You know, Alphonse was a carpenter. That's how he started his life. And right now he's running an after-school and summer, mostly a summer program, for kids where they can do some of these things, combine what we think of as school skills with real craftsmanship. And he also does some, continues to do as an out, now he's, that's his full-time job. His part-time job is he comes, spends a lot of time in the school helping us do more real skilled work with kids. And he even comes out here occasionally and does a little carpentry for me. Now, it was the respect which the staff had for good craftsmanship that I think, it's not just that you have a course on it, but that you respect it as an important human talent, mm-hmm. And respect the people who have that talent. And I think too often in our schools, we look upon those things as kind of frills that help kids, amuse themselves and don't take them seriously as important parts of our human capacity.
Right, absolutely.
We are builders. We are storytellers and we are builders. Those are the two hallmarks of humans.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I want to go to the question you raised there about the idea in the Boston public schools was to learn from pilot schools such as yours that were deliberately given a lot of flexibility to innovate and create effective and wonderful public schools. But somehow that didn't really happen. And in fact, it seems to have kind of gone the other way now with all this emphasis on standardized testing as essential for promotion.
You've answered your question. The trouble is, by the way, there are more pilot schools probably, you know, than there used to be.
Yeah.
But they're all struggling for something that, in a way, Boston isn't Boston's fault. Now, I have a few things to criticize them for, but in a sense, they started this pilot project just as another project was coming down the track called standardization and testing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a solution to if all kids were taught exactly the same way or if all kids were taught exactly the same things and if teachers were measured by their students' results on test scores and on and on and on. And, I don't think Paysant was a supporter of that idea, although it may have been more friendly than I was. And he did try to to shelter schools in Boston from some of the worst aspects of it. But in the long run, I think it may have even affected the decision he made to retire at some point.
Mm.
And we never anticipate how powerful this top-down mandates on teachers and children so that no one was expected to exercise any judgment or, you know, when I describe the staff sitting around and talking and playing with ideas and then thinking through how would we do this and, well, that would mean we have to switch this and then all leaving the room with great enthusiasm. That was harder and harder to do, and we needed more support, not less support, from the levels above us, and we actually got less and less support. Now, Mission Hill is still there. They made us move into another neighborhood, which took a lot of energy and was hard. But the school is still flourishing. But it takes up more of the principal's time to try to figure out how to live in this world and stay in the world that made the school so strong. It's heart. And she's wonderful, Allie Gavins, and she's done a marvelous job. Just went to visit last week. So I'm full of enthusiasm. But it was hard to spread the idea when people would say, but how are we allowed, to do that? And they didn't, in a sense, the schools that were already well-established probably had an opportunity to hold on to their practices in a way that new schools starting had more time, more trouble. So even the new pilot schools were more modest in their ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of pilot was precisely to learn from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. Let's try, let schools try this and let's learn from them. But the motto today is let's learn from the top. We'll ask people who have never been in classrooms, organizations, think tanks made up of people who are academic experts or business people, and they will invent ideas for schools, and we will be told to carry them out.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reverse idea. It doesn't learn from history. It doesn't learn from practitioners. It doesn't learn from parents. Lots of these, the charter schools have some of that freedom, but they're not in, but the people who make the decisions in charter schools are boards and think tanks and who are made up of corporate and business people and sometimes former teachers who treat the staff somewhat disrespectfully. So while they have the greater freedom, they don't exercise a lot of it.
Yeah, it's very disturbing to me to see the direction that public education has been taking. You know, since I could see it as Veronica's parent there at the Mission Hill School, and that's right when standardized testing hit Massachusetts. And it just seemed like such the opposite way of what we need to do. I mean, I actually liked testing when I was a student, and I think some testing is helpful. But what I have deep concern about is to just use standardized testing as something that actually drives the curriculum and is mm-hmm. the primary, if not the sole...
Oh, data-driven.
Basis. Yeah.
Data-driven schooling is the greatest idea. So, you know, you can learn from almost anything, bad experiences and good experiences. But if you're judged by those experiences and they drive decisions made about your life, that's pretty scary, rather than decisions close to the people who know you best. The decision makers are as far away as possible. And the power rests as far from where the child lives as possible. And which means also that children don't learn from adults who make judgments. The adults in most schools today, all they can say to the parents and the kid is, this is the way we're told we have to do it.
Yes.
And that's not a good model for raising young people. There are times you have to say that.
Right.
But you also want kids to respect these adults who are really exposing you to a way of thinking through and making judgments.
Well, we need to pause now for a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about some of the challenges now in public education and maybe what could be done in order
okay.
to, if you're a parent or just a concerned citizen who wants a good mm-hmm. public education, what is it that we could do to deal with this push on standardized testing so that we can actually have a real quality analytic fun education for the next generation?
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back okay. in just a minute.
Okay.
Let's give them something to talk about, baby.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Deborah Meyer, author of The Power of Their Ideas and other books about education. And by the way, her website is deborahmeyer.com. It's Deborah, M-E-I-E-R.com.
So, and Deborah with an H at the end.
And Deborah with an H. So just before the break, we were talking about the challenge to public education created by this push on standardized testing, and then maybe what we could do about it to encourage greater excellence for all our mm-hmm. students in public schools. So just to dive a little deeper into the...
Could I suggest one thing, by the way,
sure.
before that I think it's possible that it's the drive to privatize that drove the standardization method rather than the other way around. That is the real energy behind this, which has been around for some time, not totally new, against, quote, government schools and against government everything. And we have a lot of that going on all over the country. You know, that we have a substantial portion of our military are now mercenaries, not soldiers belonging to a private company. And that's happening in many areas. And I think, you know, education is a big money field in this country. If you count up all the money we spend on education. And I think some people want to get their hands on it or believe, just ideologically believe, that private is better than public. And I think once you start thinking that way, then you feel you need something other than democracy to take care of quality. In other words, democracy is a way of holding people accountable for their work. But if you decide not to have democracy but to see schools as part of a marketplace, then I think standardization begins to seem logical. You know, that you need some coin of the realm that everybody can be compared with so that you can shop around for the best school. Anyway, I think a lot of this is driven by marketplace ideology plus greed. So anyway, that's just it's looking at the same thing from different angles. And in either case, it's disturbing because I think the most important thing we have to teach in school is a love of democracy and the skills and habits of mind to sustain it even in tough times.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
You're not going to learn that in schools designed to ignore democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, now there are some charters, by the way, that I love. And those are the charters that have boards that are made up. It's a single charter. It's a mom-and-pop store. And the board of trustees are parents, teachers, and students of that school. That's different than a very large number of the charters we're seeing in this country, and increasingly vouchers, which you simply give families a certain amount of money and they can spend it in any school they choose.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you don't have to give them the money, but you give them the promise of the money to any school they choose. So I think that's scary, and I don't think there's been any discussion of it. You know, it's not as though the public has ever been into a discussion about whether we prefer privatized versus public schools. So that's part of what I'm scared of, that there are more and more very big decisions being made in this country which aren't on the table for discussion.
Right. Well, I think you're highlighting here a critical issue, and it is one of those kind of subterranean issues. But the first thing, even just with standardized testing, you know, whether it stays as public schools or moves towards greater privatization, just the standardized testing itself is a huge business.
Mm-hmm.
And all the money
that's
made in designing and applying these tests mm-hmm. and then scoring them, and then there's the whole side industry of this is the way that students are going to be judged and evaluated, then the parents are running to the testing preparation
mm-hmm.
companies.
There's a way to control teachers so they won't sabotage the reforms when the door gets closed because they'll be judged by these tests. And now there are something they call predictive tests, which you take three times a year, and twice a year you take math and English language. And then these predictive tests are to predict how well you'll do. So they are sort of, excuse me, something. I'm cough drop. they are designed to make sure you're where you should be, you know, that you're getting closer to where you'll have to be on the test in June.
Yeah.
So that it really controls how the teachers spend the year in a place like Mission Hill, where we, from kindergarten through eighth grade, we all study the same thing at the same time, but in different ways. That kind of curriculum will be hard to sustain if we are forced to take those tests.
Right. Well, and
so they're just, it's as though somebody's pretending that we have the answer and imposing it on everybody, rather than, you know, there's no evidence for this direction we're moving in, which in New York, something like half of a teacher's rating will be on the basis of student tests. And then the teachers who don't teach English and math, the art teacher, the homeroom teacher, may do both, may not. Those teachers are judged on the math and English tests. So the phys ed teacher is judged on the basis of the school's test scores in math and English.
Yeah.
Until they invent a test to measure them on phys ed, a test to measure art, you know, all the things. That's their claim. Eventually, they'll have a test for everything.
Right. And it's moving very rapidly in that direction. You know, this whole push for what's called the Common Core State Standards tests have been spreading rapidly throughout the country. And
the training that all the teachers, the money. Then we had to bring in these trainers from these think tanks and corporate bodies who train the teacher on how to teach the Common Core, which is a totally new curriculum. And then, of course, there are the tests themselves, which haven't been tried out but are going to be given throughout the country this year, next year. Some were given this year and will be used, as I say, to judge schools. It's, you know, 50 schools in Chicago, my old hometown, are closed for next year because of their test scores. And all those children are being dispersed to other schools. And so the school's future, the teachers in those schools are out of jobs. That's a lot of things that depend on a completely untested instrument.
Right. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, the Common Core state standards tests are going to be in the public schools by the year 2014, which is the next academic year, 2014 to 2015. Public schools in 45 states and the District of Columbia.
Well, more and more states are dropping out. I'm happy.
Oh, they are. Oh, so there's
largely. Okay. And I want to suggest some places that you can get more information about this. If some of the states that are dropping out, I'm happy to say, are dropping out. Not, well, maybe for my reasons, for what we think of as right-wing reasons. And that makes sense. These are the people who have argued for state rights. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government has any jurisdiction over how to raise your children. So there's a lot of opposition coming from people who are afraid that the curriculum will have a liberal bent or will require them to teach creation. Non-creationism, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So, and I always counted on those folks for making it hard to have federal mandates in education. But it took a while till they had woken up to the fact that they should be opposed to this also. Then there's a whole bunch of groups. I mean, people should look into Diane Ravitch's blog. And she blogs, but she also brings in a lot of people, different people. She turns her blog over to parents and teachers and experts, and it's in the, you know, it's DianeRavitch.net.
And that's Diane Ravitch, R-A-V-I-T-C-H.
Right, and Diane with an E at the end.
Yes.
And so there's my blog, there's hers, there's something, a blog called, a blog group, which is called Opt Out, let me see if I can get the exact name. Opt out of the state test. My goodness.
Mm-hmm.
and movement. Let me see if I can see up here how they get to that.
While you're checking that, I'll just let our listeners know that Diane Ravitz was very high up in the Department of Education under President George W. Bush. So she comes out of a place where originally she was supportive of the whole No Child Left Behind legislation and the standardized testing. But the more she saw it being applied and saw what was really happening, the more of an opponent of standardized testing that she became. So she's now someone who is challenging this Common Core and the standardized testing push, which, you know, good for her for being open to actually looking at the evidence of what this is doing to our public education system.
Yeah, she's always been a very strong advocate of public education with a kind of conservative, neoconservative bent. And when the more she got to know about how these were about testing, first of all, and then the use of testing as a high-stakes decision-maker, she began to, you know, start looking more broadly at what was going on and decided that she was in the wrong camp. So there's a thread. I just going through my some archives I have, and I found some of my old arguments back and forth with her. And it's interesting to see where there's a constancy. She hasn't abandoned all her beliefs. She has abandoned some ideas about the route to accomplish what she wants.
Right, which is fabulous. And but, you know, back on the Common Core, this is exactly case in point of what you were talking about. Here is a major shift happening in education across the country. And, in fact, the New York Times recently called the Common Core the most far-reaching experiment in American educational history, with a radical curriculum that has had very little, if any, public discussion.
It's amazing. It is, you know, and believe me, none of the legislations that decided to go along with it. Each state did have to vote to go along with it, but nobody read them. You know, both Republicans and Democratic leadership is supporting this, so that. And as I say, there's about seven or eight states now that have pulled out.
Well, that's very encouraging. So
maybe over time more will, and that may make it hard to pursue this path. But it's not that I'm neither an optimist or a pessimist. What I'm worrying about is democracy, and I see the blows to the idea that we need to talk and decide together at all levels. Some things need to be decided together nationally, some statewide, some community-wide, some school-wide. And we're getting away from that idea. So it even should happen, or that it isn't just cranks who think that they should have a voice. So the people who are the people who made up this Common Core were not even university or high school teachers. It was made up by groups, corporate think tanks. It's startling that this could happen. But then I'm startled when I realize how many, that the existence of a mercenary army in this country and the number of prisons that are run for profit. And I'm the very idea and the difference in wages between people at the top and the bottom, all of these run contrary to the history of this country and the beliefs and strivings that underlie our nation. And so it's happened without our consent.
Right. It's almost like just undercover, this dramatic upheaval and a shift in direction for education. So what can we do about it, do you think? What would you say to parents or citizens?
Well, I think they just have to mobilize parents in their own neighborhood. Find out where the teachers stand on this, because they may be able to join together rather than make this a fight between parents and teachers. Mobilize people, some of the community organizations, find out how the local school board thinks about it. Get in touch with some of these organizations, like the opt-out of this group, to see how parents in many places in this country have decided to opt out for their own children. And have been successful without getting their children penalized. They all get the first answer is no, you can't do that. And then in a very large number of cases, the school systems have to acknowledge in the end, yes, you can do that. So I think in all those levels, see your state legislators, your congressional legislators, insist that they read the standards or take the test. That's one of my best ideas, that every legislature has to take the test that they require students take.
Mm-hmm.
And see if they can do as well as ninth graders are required to do. You know, adults taking those tests really have a shocking experience. They don't realize how much they have forgotten because it never was useful.
Mm-hmm. Right. I remember my father actually was a high school dropout. He made it, I think, up to the eighth grade. When he went in to high school, he took algebra and then flunked it. And then he said to me that he would rather sign up and go to World War II and face the Nazis than face algebra again.
Well, you know what's amazing is the number of people who use advanced algebra and calculus in this country is .01 probably. My brother's an architect. He says architects don't use any of it. If they need get something, they push a button and get the answer.
Right.
But he said they very rarely even need to. The New York Times, I think it was 2 weeks ago, had an editorial finally acknowledging that there is no shortage of skills in this country. The reason we go abroad and outsource and bring foreigners in is because they'll work for less.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a skill shortage, but what they're upping is the ante. In order to get a job that you don't need any algebra for, you have to have a high school diploma, but a college diploma. And now, pretty soon, it will be you'll have to have a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so that more and more people are getting in debt because the system has been set up so they have to go to school until they're 22 and now 24, 25 years old. That's absurd. And they have to pay for the last eight of it, which makes them all the more, makes it harder and harder to find a job.
Right.
There's just a contradiction between all these things.
Right. So, well, getting back to our original idea here about learning from schools like Central Park East and Mission Hill, I know you mentioned some things that parents could do in order to address education in their community or
mm-hmm.
state. Do you see kind of in a bigger picture way, kind of, what, or maybe that's just it, but the pathway so that we can have more schools like Central Park East
mm-hmm.
and Mission Hill all across the United States?
Well, I think we have to decide that which decisions are made where. And we need to be sure that we maintain a society in which decisions that are really about child rearing stay close to children and families,
mm-hmm.
and that ideas about community institutions, which schools are, stay close to communities. You know, the most taxes for schools are still paid for by local taxes. So even on that argument, we need to depend more on local people, and we need to depend on institutions where we can see democracy at work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that should be the basis of schools. Then we need to, we can have all the published standards we want. And parents can say, I want us to take this test, or I want to do that, because I want to see how we, that somebody else isn't deciding on the stakes. So that schools decide when they want a second opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I don't trust my doctor entirely. If I am nervous about his recommendation, I get a second opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's an insult to the doctor. Sometimes doctors don't take it well, but they should.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we have to trust our teachers or the school board 100%. We need to get second opinions and sometimes even a third opinion. And I think we can build not only better schooling out of that, more kids who love to read and more kids who can handle arithmetic and on and on and on, at the same time in which we strengthen the roots of the country. I don't think there's a conflict there.
Mm-hmm.
I think the two can really go together very well. And sure, some school boards and some schools will happily keep doing some stupid things. And they'll think I'm doing stupid things. But, you know, did you see there was a, I guess it's YouTube, on Central Park, on Mission Hill, did you see it?
No, what happened there?
There was 10 sessions. It took 20 weeks. They were shown every other week, called A Year at Mission Hill. You can, I guess, get it through your Google or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
A Year at Mission Hill. And what's interesting, or maybe it says A Year at Mission Hill School. What's interesting is that I'd like to know people who, some people may look at it and say, oh, I wouldn't want that for my child. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But we need ways in which parents can see what other kinds of schooling looks like. Look at how the Finnish educate their children or the Chinese. I mean, rather than getting all this phony data, which we don't know how much is real or not real or what it's based on, the best data is looking at stuff with our own two eyes and our from colleagues to bounce ideas around and make a judgment about what is best for my community and my child.
Yeah. Well, and I find it very interesting that a lot of the private schools, which, you know, some people see them as higher quality education, but the private schools that can opt out of the standardized testing are staying away from it. I mean, you don't...
Oh, absolutely.
You don't see them running for Common Core.
No. No, and they're distinguished for their interesting curriculum. I mean, people go to certain schools because of the way they have of approaching curriculum. And you're absolutely right. They don't take a test to tell them what's good and bad. They get class size down to 15. You know, all the private schools in New York City that anyone tries to get their kids into, I think Bank Street has 20 kids in a class, and the rest of them are all around 15.
Mm.
And public schools, it's 30, 35, 28. And the justification for it is it doesn't affect test scores. But they've trained us to think that something is only good if it affects test scores, whereas the private school parents are allowed to make judgments about what's good for their kids on a much broader basis.
Mm-hmm.
They know their kid is thinking better, talking better, making arguments better. And that's probably because of class size.
And that's what we all want for our kids, is that kind of, top-level education for analytic ability, not this kind of let's push them so they can do well on the test that, you know, Bill Gates Foundation thinks is a good idea. I wanted to ask you quickly about that because it was, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation put about $35 million in grants to support the whole Common Core push in education. But if I remember correctly, I think you were an advisor to the Gates Foundation on education at some point. And what happened to them?
Yes, they did love me once.
Yeah, but, yes.
Well, that's the trouble with getting people who don't know a lot about the subject themselves. So.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody persuaded them that small schools was a good idea, and so they jumped in wholeheartedly. And when at the end of 5 years, the kids' scores were not substantially different. I think on the whole they were slightly better, but not there wasn't leaps in test scores. They decided, well, maybe that's not the answer. And then they have spent $35 million. Is it only a million? Might be billion. On schools based on a testing model. Now, they've been at this for more than 10 years, so I don't know. They didn't give us as much time as they're giving the current reform movement because, but partly because they have built a whole array of what do you want to call them? I wonder, what do we call these people who meet the Koch brothers, the so that even the foundations that used to be have for generations been sympathetic to progressive ideas, like Carnegie and Ford Foundation, and they have joined that. because it seems silly to be not to be in the tent mm-hmm. with the big givers. So it's hard to get even small grants for anything but that agenda.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can convince some people with wealth to be pushing the other way. And if we get people...
Oh, if there's some wealthy person on listening to this show.
That's right. Here you go. Here's your chance to leave a
even
legacy.
Even if they're not so wealthy. You know, we have one organization that is in the business of critiquing tests, the Cold Fair Test. It's in Boston. And Fair Test, it's worth getting online and looking up Fair Test. Fair Test hires the equivalent of two people, mm-hmm. has a budget of a few hundred thousand dollars a year. It is the only organization in America that is in the business of telling the other story.
Deborah, I'm sorry to cut this short, and I want to have you back again sometime, but we're out of time for today.
Yes, we could go on forever, you and I, Eleanor.
Yes, absolutely, and I look forward to the next time.
And love to everyone.
Thank you.
And to say hello to it.
Thank you.
Okay,
yes, thank you so much.
Hi.
And for our listeners, to please go to learn more about Deborah Meyer's work at deborahmeyer.com. That's DeborahMeyer. deborahmeyer.com for her blog, her books, and all we need about education. In case you've missed any of the other programs, they're available in our archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Daniel Ellsberg, a famous whistleblower who released the Pentagon Papers that helped end the Vietnam War, to talk with him about the latest whistleblower, Edward Snowden, and the information he released about the government spying on Americans. Thank you for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.